Okay, good morning to everybody. We'll be starting the class momentarily. Just wait for a couple more people to join and for the phone call to come in. And we'll be taking up today the topic of the formation of the Jewish people and what events God deemed were vital subsequent and even during the Exodus. And again, we'll start the class just momentarily. This will be in terms of source material. We're referring to the actual Exodus, which is in 12:34 in Parshas Bo in Exodus, and also the verse in Mara where they had the bitter water. We're picking up from last week. We were discussing God's plan for them to have an experience of bitter water, and then God would make it sweet for them. So that's in chapter 15. Verse 25, around there, we'll be taking up. And once you hear the audio, I just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen to confirm for us that you're picking up the audio feed properly. And Mike USA, thanks a lot for the confirmation of the audio. During the class, you see the screen has an error. Sometimes it happens. No technology is perfect. All you have to do is just re-enter. You just click the Talk Live link on the top left, or sometimes just hitting your Enter key is sufficient. Last week's class regarding a new point that we did not address, and that was what the purpose of God taking the Jews to the bitter waters, if there was a place of 12 pools of fresh water and 70 date palms, which apparently was very close by. God could have taken them there directly after the splitting of the sea and the killing of the Egyptians. But God chose to take them to a place of bitter water first to teach them a lesson, and also to teach them three areas of Torah law. That's what we're going to take up today. Okay, D. Atlanta, thanks a lot for the confirmation. Najar, I guess it's in Reading, Pennsylvania. Looks like you're saying you have the audio now. Good. Okay, Noah in New York. Menachem, thanks for the confirmation on the audio. And for those of you who are listening to this class in as an audio file, meaning after the class is over, this is a live class, so we wait for people to join, so we do pause at 5 minutes until everybody has joined the class. But then the class will go without break, usually for about an hour. And we're just waiting a moment until our friends call in, and we'll have everybody here and we'll start. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Good morning, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. Good to hear. You have a good week?
Yeah.
Good.
I make my last trip for about 3 weeks, so I think I get to be home for a while.
That's right. You travel a lot. Okay.
You have a lot of snow there right now?
A lot of what?
Oh, we've been reading about upstate New York.
I haven't seen a flake in about a year.
Oh, wow.
They were hit bad?
Pardon me?
They were hit with a lot of snow?
Up in upstate New York.
They've got 8 feet.
Come on.
I'm not kidding. 110 inches in Parrish. I believe that part of it's been declared a disaster area.
My goodness.
And more expected, I think.
Is that near Buffalo, or that area?
No, I'm honestly not sure. They just said sort of central and upstate New York.
My goodness, 8 feet of snow. It's probably not good. I mean, I'm sure there've been. I mean, unfortunately, but were there any casualties or anything because of that? People can't move around. They can't get away.
You know, ironically, they said there have not been any reported deaths. I mean, I probably would have expected with that much snow there would be, but
yeah.
Apparently not.
Wow. All right.
But it's getting, I guess, pretty old for them trying to remove it all.
Well, hopefully they'll get a little reprieve and get it cleared up for themselves. All right. All right, so we're going to continue today with the topic we were discussing last week. Okay, so that topic was the event of God taking the Jews out of Egypt. They went through the Red Sea, and they got to a place called Marah, and basically because Marah means bitter, God had planned, there was a destination, that they should come to a place with this bitter water, and they would ask Moses to pray to God, or to resolve the issue. Which Moses did. He prayed to God, and God showed Moses the wood that when you put it into the water, it sweetens the water. So we addressed that whole plan because we see that was definitely that was intentional. That was intentional that they should come to this place because we see right next door a place called Elim that there were 70 date trees, date palms, and 12 pools of fresh water. So God could have taken them there immediately. It wasn't too far away from Marah. So why did God take them to Marah first? So we said it was because we suggested that everything that the Jews had witnessed about God up to this point was negative. There were the 10 plagues and the destruction of the Egyptians on the seashore. And I admitted that there is a salvation in the actual destruction. I mean, the Jews were saved through the destruction of the Egyptians. But it wasn't purely a positive. However, when they came to Marah and their bitter waters became sweet, that was a positive miracle. And this, I suggested, was done in order to neutralize what may have been a view of God that was too weighted towards God being a punitive God, one who punishes, and they didn't see any positive. So it was a suggestion. But it definitely is clear that it was a destination. There was a plan for God to come here, and they should now experience sweetness. But again, that was also tied to a second idea, and that was that the very verse that talks about that God made the water sweet also was conditional that they keep the Torah. They were given three commands, and there's a dispute as to what the commands were. But we're going to take one view in the Talmud, and that's what we're going to address now, as to what exactly those commands were, and why were they apropos at this point. So we'll address that in a second. But the plan was that they should now have the sweetness associated with laws. So that shows you that the saving, the salvation of the Jews was not purely unconditional. It came along, and that's why it's in one verse. God joins two things in one verse to show that there's an integral relationship between the two. So the verse says that he made the water sweet, and this is Exodus 15:25. So they cried to God regarding the bidness of, Moses cried to God. And God instructed him on a certain wood, and he threw it into the waters that were bitter, and they became sweet and drinkable. And then the verse concludes and says there was placed before them a statute and a law, and there they were tried. There the Jews were tried, meaning to say that it was a trial of sorts. So you see in one verse, this is part of understanding how to learn, is to understand that there's many traditions that were handed down. One of them, which is vital to studying the written Torah, is to know that one verse that has a couple of ideas, those ideas are all related. So if the verse says that the waters were made sweet, but it was also that they were given laws, that means that they're related. And the relationship, we can see, is clear, that God will assist them and involve himself in their lives on the condition that they are fulfilling what he created human beings for. And that is to be involved in studying and using their intelligence, because this is the one apparatus that we have that no other creation has. So God did not just create man for the sake of just roaming the earth. And there's actually in Sanhedrin, in the Talmud Sanhedrin, it talks about the difference between the laws of the Ben Noach and the laws of Adam. And it's very surprising. Maybe we'll continue with this next week, but it's surprising that there's a verse that we learn out the seven Noahide laws from. And that's a verse which God says to Adam. He addresses Adam and says that V'yitzav Hashem Elokim al Adam Lamor, he commanded man, saying, from all the trees of the garden you can surely eat. So that's the verse. We know how it ends. The next verse comes in and says, but from the tree of knowledge you can't eat. Okay? Oh, by the way, Doug and Cal, how's it sound today? Is it all right?
Oh, great.
Good. Okay. Okay. Good. Okay, so this verse is addressed to Adam. But it's amazing that according to Rabbi Yochanan, who made the statement, he says that this teaches Noah the seven laws, not Adam. It's interesting. What did Rabbi Yochanan? I mean, this statement was stated to Adam. God says to Adam that from all the trees you may eat, but from the tree of knowledge you can't. But if we just take the one verse, that verse that God stated to Adam, which states again, God commanded man, say, from all the trees of the garden you can surely eat. That verse is where they derive. Every single word teaches out a new command. And the totality of the ideas in that verse are seven. And Rabbi Yochanan says that those seven are applied to the Noahides. It's funny, though, that it bypasses Adam. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't say that Adam was commanded in seven, which is amazing because the verse was stated to Adam. So how is it that God verbalizes something to Adam, but it doesn't apply to him? It's not going to apply until Noah. See, you hear the question, right? If I would tell somebody, a certain thing, but now I say that thing I tell you applies to, 10 generations from now, that would be odd. You'd think when I address an individual, I'm addressing him and what the content of my statement applies to him. Rabbi Yehuda, towards the end of that page, it's page 56b in Sanhedrin, and he says that Adam was commanded only on one thing, and that was idolatry. And some say he's also commanded on not cursing God as a second, and then another view is that he was commanded even on a third thing, and that was to set up courts. But nobody says he was commanded on seven, which is amazing, again, for the reason I'm stressing here, that the verse was addressed to Adam. But the reason I'm bringing this up now is because according to Rabbi Yehuda, who's the first view on this latter part of the Talmud, and he says that Adam was only commanded in one thing, idolatry. It's an amazing thing. It's amazing that God would create man, and he just gives him one command. Later on, he gives Noah 7, and then later on, he gives the Jews 613. So there is something to be understood here. And this, I think, is the same concept that we are deriving from Mora. That's why I'm bringing it up. Because you see, the God did not make the water sweet and intervene for the Jews separate from anything else. He intervened and made it sweet contingent upon their acceptance of the system of the Torah. That's why it's together in one verse. I'm making the water sweet. I'm now allowing you to drink after 3 days of not having water. But this is on the condition that I give you these three commands. He started out and gave him three commands, and that's what we're going to take up. What are those three commands? And I think it'll really be a real eye-opener. And remind me, if I forget, that the three commands correlate to something else. It correlates to the three, is also the same three, you'll see. It correlates to an area of cursing. The Torah addresses three beings that you're not allowed to curse. And they're the exact same that these commands address that they got at Mara. But let's just tie up here with Adam. What I'm bringing up about Adam is that God didn't just create Adam with no commands. Okay? That's something which is just, that didn't happen. So the question is, what is this idea of that God creates man, and as he creates him, he gives him one command. And the command is idolatry. But the question is, why couldn't man exist without that one command? And again, sometimes the screen, for those of you that are joining online today, the screen goes blank. You'll still hear the audio, but just you could log back in just by clicking the Talk Live link on the top left and then just re-entering the room. So you'll be fine with that. As I mentioned earlier, the technology is not perfect, so you know it's definitely we'll take it as is. It works, you know, 95%. But the sound, you shouldn't have any problem with the sound. Okay. So the reason why God creates man and he immediately gives him a command is this idea that man doesn't have the right just to exist. God didn't just make man and then he could just roam the earth, because had God not given a command to Adam, so now what would have Adam thought? He would have thought that I am now created. He would have recognized, and he would have just as wise, he understood that he was just created, that he didn't exist prior to this. He would have been amazed at that, but if there was no command upon him, then his view of his existence would be different. He would not view his existence as contingent upon recognizing God and following God's rules. It's a very hard thing for a person's ego to accept, but we are all created, and we are not just here because of some natural event and without any type of purpose. God created human beings. He did the biggest act of kindness he ever did to man is to create man, to give man existence, and to allow man the ability to perceive the amazing knowledge and the truth that there's a creator. That's just it is a mind-blowing concept. And this is something which the greatest mind, Moses, asked God, show me your nature. Hareini na kivodecha, which literally means show me your honor, means what is the essence of your honor, God? Meaning, how do you exist? What is the nature of your existence that you exist in? It's just our minds just can't fathom that something exists of itself. Everything we see exists because it had a creation. But something that can exist independently, that's an amazing thing. And that's what God told to Moses. He said to Moses, and Rabbi Chait explained this, that why would this be something which, when he asked them, when Moses asked God, you know, I'm going to the Jews before his mission to go down to Egypt. So he had a long discussion with God, and he said, the Jews will ask me, what's his name? What should I tell them? So God says, I am that I am. I am that I am, as Rabbi Chait explained, means that I am the being that is. I am that I am. I am the thing which is, meaning I am the only thing which has essential existence. So I am that I am means to say a new concept that when Moses tells to the people, they would realize, oh, he couldn't have come up with this idea by himself. the fact that Moses now has this idea that there is an existence which is essential existence is not something we see in reality. And the only way he could have now stated this to the Jews when he finally got to Egypt was if he was informed of this, because this is not something you witness in nature. Man can only extrapolate from what he sees, his senses, and then he comes up with ideas. But there's certain areas that are just impossible to know independently. And the same thing happened with Abraham. When God says that he's going to destroy Sodom, God narrates a very interesting statement in the Torah. And he says, "Amachasa ani me'avram, she'ani oseh, am I going to keep concealed from Abraham what I'm going to do," meaning referring to destruction of Sodom. So when God says, "Will I keep concealed," that implies that if he doesn't tell Abraham about what he's going to do in terms of the ideas of justice and God's considerations of why he's going to destroy Sodom, I mean, if God does not do that, then all Abraham is going to see the next day is a destroyed five cities, Sodom and Amorah, the entire plain, he would just see destroyed. However, God wanted to engage Abraham in a discussion to give Abraham knowledge about God's justice. And that's exactly what God says in the subsequent verse. Because God says, am I going to keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do? And Abraham is going to be a great nation. And he will command his household after him in the ways of God. So because Abraham was an individual that is going to teach others, God had to now unveil new ideas that Abraham could not have reached on his own. And that's basically what the idea of prophecy is that there are certain areas and a tremendous amount we can learn on our own, but prophecy is the areas that are unavailable to man, and therefore God tells man. So this idea as well is that when Moses told the people that, what's the proof that I spoke with God? Because of his name. I am that I am. Now Moses conveyed an idea that you cannot perceive in nature. Nature will not tell you that there is something which is essential existence. That everything in nature, when you look at it, you recognize that it had to be created. But you could ask a question, which I'm just thinking now, is that, well, why couldn't a person extrapolate from nature that there's something like Abraham? So maybe Abraham was able to see this idea. It's a good question, because Abraham came up with the idea that, you know, of monotheism, and he must have had the correct idea regarding God. So it could be that we can just modify the statement. It's not that it's impossible for man to get the knowledge, but it's highly unlikely. Okay. All right, So what we see from this is that there was that man's existence, going back now, we took a little tangent, but it's okay. Man's existence demands that he recognizes he is here for a purpose. So that's why even Adam had to have some command. Because this fact that God now commanded me, Adam said to himself, therefore I see that my existence is for this objective of following God. He did not just put me here with intelligence just to have a life to follow as I choose. He wants me to follow him. But at the same time, it's amazing, God only gave him one command. Now, let's just pause here for a second just to see if all the ideas are clear. We said a couple of things. Let me just pause, see if anybody has a question or just clarification. Everything good there, Doug, Cal?
Yep, we're good.
Okay. All right. So now we see one very big lesson. This is the first lesson we're getting today, is that we see that man has an objective to follow God, that he is subservient. And that subservience is taught by the lesson of God giving a command to man. It can be one command, it can be 613. Or it could be seven. But no man, no generation was ever bereft of having commands from God. And this is to teach the primary lesson that, like we're saying, man must recognize that he is here for a purpose and to follow God. But it's not for God that we're doing it, keep in mind. It's not that God wants to have slaves and that we should now be subservient just for the purpose of being subservient like a king would. God did it for us. There's nothing we can give to God. These are actually words of the prophets. Ma'itainlo, what are you going to give to God? There's no benefit. God is completely self-sufficient. He has no needs. Need is a human quality. Okay. And let me just ask everybody who's listening on screen right now, just we want to confirm one more time that the audio is okay. So if you could type audio okay at the bottom of the screen, it'll just confirm that the audio is going well today. Okay, so the first lesson we now see. What's the second lesson? Second lesson is that God gave Adam only, he gave man only one command. Now, why is that? Why would you think he gave Adam only one command and that was it? You see that we have 613 or 7. But now let me just embellish on that. The Talmud states that there's some views that say that even Adam had two commands, and another view says three. But that's it. But it's interesting. Those second and third commands, according to those other views, are derived from the first and only statement of command. God said that he is God. God commanded on man that he is God, basically, that I am God, you should have no others. That means idolatry. So that one command of idolatry, the rabbis say, based on idolatry, that since God is God, then there's no other. So what comes along with that is a secondary command of not to curse him, because since he's God and there's no other, therefore there has to be a certain relationship that we have. But it's not a statement in the Torah not to curse, according to this view. The concept, the understanding of not cursing God, or the command, is something which God allowed Adam to derive himself just from one statement. God said one statement to Adam, I am God. From that, the rabbis and the Talmud say, so therefore he can't be involved in idolatry, and he also can't curse God. And even more, another rabbi comes in, another view comes in, and says, on top of that, since God is God, so man must then fear God in his heart and try to follow what he can from what God desires of man. But the point is that these were not verbally communicated. These were derivative. These were only derived by Adam using his mind. The question is, why did God want Adam to have the commands that way? For us, and for Ben Noach, he spells them out. But even for Ben Noach, it's not something which is like a command like we have today. All the commands we have today are clear in the Torah. Wear tefillin, put on tzitzis, eat kosher. All these things are clear individual statements in the Torah. By Ben Noach, it's more vague. It's one statement, but they correlate each word to having a meaning, and that meaning they derive a command. But by Adam, it's completely abstract. God makes one statement, and Adam is now supposed to derive from that additional few commands. I mean, you're not even using a secondary word to correlate to a second command like by Noach. So the question is, what does this teach us? What does this teach us that God gave Adam a statement that I am God, but that he should now derive from that statement other commands? What does that tell us? That's the question. Okay, is the question clear, everybody?
Yes, Rabbi, that it's telling him that he wants Adam to use his mind.
Exactly. Exactly. Right, meaning God is showing you that the original plan that he made, the original plan that he intended, is that man would be completely self-sufficient. He has everything he needs. With man's mind, with the intelligence, the tselem elokim, right, the soul, with that alone, God is basically saying you have everything you need now to live the proper life. The only thing you don't know is that you have a relationship to me, therefore I have to give you a command to show you that I am the commander and you are the one that should follow it. Again, this is all for your own good. But the only thing that was missing was the concept of the relationship. So therefore God gives a command now to set up the relationship between man and God. Now the man understands that relationship, that's all he needs. So exactly as you're saying, Doug. So the only thing that was missing was to have the concept of the relationship. Now once he has that, man's mind is able to extrapolate And that's why nothing else had to be told to him. To teach the very point that you have everything you need. I created you perfect. The mind that I gave you is and it was like the Ibn Ezra says, one of the greatest commentaries in the Torah, he says that Adam was a chacham gadol, a great intellect. So God created Adam, a complete adult, and he also had a mature process of thinking already. And now he would teach his children, and they would teach others, but they would be able to just use their mind and derive. This is exactly what Abraham did. Abraham had no teacher, and he was immersed in idolatry like everybody else in that time, that era. But he was able to extricate himself just using his intelligence and figuring out that this has to be false. We can't bow down to a rock. We can't say that physical objects are causes of the fate of man, or that they created the universe. These things are created, so there has to be something outside the physical realm which did the act of creating. Okay. So it's interesting, huh, Doug?
Very much so.
Yeah, very interesting. Right. I mean, the lesson is very subtle, but that's what the Rabbi Chaid explained, that the person should be involved, and all of his time should be involved in Talmud, because you see that the Talmud is written in a way that it just throws you some hints. It's written just like the style of the Torah. Just enough information is there that you have the question, but then you start thinking into it, you start seeing a beautiful answer comes out. So it prods thinking. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
One thing that I notice here is that when God created Adam, he had more of a direct relationship with Adam. There wasn't a lot of other people around. But it seems like the one commandment then was probably sufficient. But as we expand the population, the ability for man to have free choice, it shows how powerful the emotions are, because then the commandments have to become more specific.
Yes, exactly. It's very good. I mean, as the emotions started taking over more, it had to become more specific. So seven commands were now correlated for Ben Noach, but even more clearly, because now you had every word in the verse alludes to a new command. And by the time we had the Torah at Sinai, we needed more commands, and they had to be explicitly stated. Right? That's what you're saying?
Right.
Yes, exactly. Very good point. Very good. All right, so Adam was on the highest level. Again, we're not talking about Adam. We know that Moses was a much higher level, but in terms of the human being, so we see that there was a progression downward. So as man progressed downward, so it had to be more clear what was desired of him, what was demanded of him. But you see that God did not have to command Adam on killing, on eating a limb from an animal, so on and so forth. These were things that he would be able to arrive at. I mean, it's not to say that the system of the Torah was not something that God wanted Adam to have. I mean, of course, in Adam's time, you couldn't have possibly had a law, don't follow the ways of Egypt, because Egypt didn't exist yet. But you would have had the concepts of charity and doing kindness for the neighbor and stealing and all the other things which are essential to society and to human perfection and recognition of God and being able to negate wrong ideas in connection with God, that he's not physical, so on and so forth. Right, but on a societal level, as it progressed, more was necessary to be revealed to man. All right. Okay, any other questions or comments before we move along? Now we're going to go back to the story and take a look at what those three commands are that God gave the Jews when he gave them that sweetened water. Right, so before we go further, if anybody has a question, you can type it on the screen, or Cal, Doug, anybody who's with you today, you know, feel free. I'll pause now.
I think we're good.
Good over there? Okay. All right, so the question we have now, there's two issues I want to address today, and that is, number one, what are those three laws that God gave at Marah when they had a bit of water, and he finally sweetened it for them, but he gave them the sweet waters and taught them three laws. Those laws were Sabbath and courts, setting up courts, and honoring parents. Right? That's the view the Gemara states. So the first question is right now, what is the common bond between honoring parents, setting up courts, and observing the Sabbath? That is the question, because those are the three that God gave to the Jews at Mara. This is before the Torah was given. And then we'll have to explain why he gave these at this specific juncture in the development of the nation.
Rabbi,
go ahead, Doug.
I'm seeing a little bit of a connection in that if we look at Sabbath as sort of honoring Hashem, so you've got honoring the creator of the universe, then you've got honoring the creators of yourself, that is your parents, who were instrumental in your existence. Then the establishment of courts is kind of honoring the society in which you live by establishing rules of justice.
So how would you boil that down? What's the common bond? And Mike USA online is just commenting that he really enjoys the question. So, Mike, I'm glad you enjoy the question. It is a good question. But you're going to see something even more amazing, too, because these three have a common bond in the Torah somewhere else. But you're saying that you're honoring God as creator with the Sabbath? Is that what you're saying, Doug?
Right.
And with parents, you're honoring parents. So you're saying honor is a common thing?
Yes, or showing respect for the kind of the your ultimate creator, the partners in your earthly creation, and the society that allows you to continue to exist. I don't have it clear enough.
All right, you have it though.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I would think that it all stems back in your relationship with God as your relationship with everything else. If you see God as the authority, then you see your relationship with your parents as honoring them or giving them the authority, which ultimately stems from God, and then you recognize the authority of the court, in a sense, of recognizing them as an authority stemming from the ultimate authority of God.
So I see it's very clear from your answer that you guys are a perfect match. Because you're both saying they're the same exact thing, different words, but yes. Right. The concept is authority, recognizing authority. And Dee in Atlanta also wanted to mention this. Alana also was just writing on. Dee says that to recognize that there is always some authority above you. And Alana was writing that to an acknowledgement of things greater than the individual. Okay. And let's just do a sound check for a moment, because some people on screen don't seem to hear anything. So if you hear the audio, just type audio okay. Again, since that's the only way we have confirmation that the audio feed is good. So if you just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen, that'll inform us that you're still picking up the stream fine. Okay. So that's exactly right. All three are dealing with recognizing authority. Your parents, the police system or the courts, and of course God. Okay, and keep in mind also, I'd like you just to know that there is a prohibition in the Torah to curse. And who's the object of the curse in the Torah? You can't curse your parents, and you figure out who the other two are. You can't curse God, right? And that's one of the Noahides, of course.
Right.
And you also can't curse a prince, meaning a leader. You see the three exact same individuals, right? The three beings that God is now telling them at Mara, these laws about honoring parents and Sabbath and setting up courts, meaning respect these three authorities, the Torah also groups them together when we see throughout the Torah that there is a punishment if you actually killed, if you curse your parents. Or God, or the Nasi. I think the Nasi as well, meaning the prince. But you see that he's the representative of the system, just like the courts. What's interesting, right? What is interesting is that it says openly in the Torah, I mean, the way God articulates commands, of course, is another great area of wisdom. So we see that God says a person can't curse God. He says openly you can't curse a prince. You can't curse a prince. But it doesn't say openly you can't curse the parents. It says the punishment. It's a passive way. It says whoever curses the parents is then killed. So the question is, why doesn't it say a positive statement, do not curse parents, like it does by the princes, like a Nasi, the leader of the Jews? There it says openly, don't curse. But by the parents, it doesn't say that. Although it says that if you do curse the parents, what the punishment is. But why would you think that it doesn't say it openly not to do it by the parent, but it does say by the prince that you shouldn't curse him? Everybody has a question? Doug?
I got the question.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure. All right, if anybody who's joining us online has the possibility, just type in the answer at the bottom of your screen. The question is why the Torah will openly state that you cannot curse the prince or the leader of the Jews. But by the parent, it doesn't say you can't do it. It just says that if you do it, then you're killed. So why doesn't it have the same level of warning by the parents as it does by the prince? I mean, it clearly indicates something. The first thing you have to say is, well, what's the indication? Meaning the degree of severity is higher for who? The degree of severity is higher for the prince, because there it's paying more attention to the formulation of the prohibition. There it openly says, do not curse the prince. And if you do, so then you're punished. But the parents, it doesn't say do not do the action. It just tells you the punishment. So there's less stated in connection with the parent. Right, so Menachem wants to say that parents are the higher level than a prince. Your parents are your direct creator. Well, if that was so, Menachem, so then you would have the command on the parents too. Do not curse the parents. But it doesn't say do not curse the parents. It would seem to indicate the opposite, that the prince is gaining more, it's more severe when you curse the prince. Why is that? See, I think the answer is, now think about it for a moment. Let me just pause. Yes, Doug.
So, if you curse the prince, it would seem that you are undermining society, which is a slightly more serious thing than if you curse your parents, which is kind of a private matter between you and them.
Well, what can it... See, cursing the person who's running the society. So it's more... I'd go in that direction, but there's more you can say. What more is the significance of the prince? I mean, again, the Jewish society is a Torah society, not just politics. So put it in that context.
Well, okay, if you curse the prince, then you are essentially undermining the whole society, which puts the society at risk. That's not the case if you curse your parents. Because others may hear you curse the prince, and they may then start to question the prince and the leader, and that may ultimately cause the destruction of the society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Menachem wants to take the other angle. He wants to say that since it's so obvious by parents, just like you're not commanded to eat human flesh, so you also don't need a command you know, to abstain from cursing your parents. So he wants to say the absence of the command is to indicate the obvious nature of it. That's what Menachem is saying. I hear that. However, there is something which you're saying, Doug, which I agree with, is that the society, meaning the Torah society, the prince is really one who's responsible for more good than your parents. And like the Gemara, the Talmud talks about and says that if your teacher, your Rebbe, and your father are both drowning, and you can only save one, who do you save? Your teacher, because your father gave you physical life, whereas your teacher gives you your eternal life. So you have to recognize which one is more central, which one is more you. It's not the body. You may love your father, the emotions may be stronger, but we have to recognize what is really more essential, more vital. So you're saying that with the society, I would just take it to the level of Torah, meaning who is it that I mean, even the parents, it's not honor for the parents per se, it's to target eventually the honor that you're going to transpose onto God. So therefore we have to be dependent infants. That's how we have to come into the world, where we develop a recognition of what authority, quote-unquote authority, is, and we accept that role as part of how we operate. Eventually to transfer that respect onto to God, and to recognize the real authority. So the prince also is more closely tied to God than the parents, because he's the one that's upholding the system of Torah. All right, like you were saying, society, but I'm just adding the word Torah society, Doug, okay?
Okay.
All right. So we see now... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you said there's a prohibition in the Torah, to curse.
Right.
Of the seven Noahide laws, we have a prohibition against blasphemy, but I thought that was only halakhically defined if done against the Creator.
Right, that's for Noahide law, but for the 613, there was added on to the Jew the princes and also the parents.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, no problem. Okay, so Menachem, I hope that answers your question. It's true that parents may be more obvious, but based on, and I'm just addressing this to you, Menachem, based on the fact that you're supposed to save your teacher before you save your father, is to show you that there's a greater level of recognition of what your life is all about, that your soul is really more important than your body. Okay, and Menachem is just adding, he says, we also learn in Baba Basra, which is one of the tractates of the Talmud, that the teacher is a substitute for the father. It may be true in a certain context, but in terms of who we have to have greater recognition for, that's what's more central to our existence. And that's the soul, not the body. Okay. Now that we understand that these three beings we cannot curse, we see that these are the same three that God commanded us at Mara to respect, the authority figures. So now my question is going to be, and it's very nice to see a parallel in the Torah, because then it shows us more that there's a theme, and it's not just an arbitrary grouping of these three beings, meaning God, the court system, the judges, the princes, and your parents are all authority figures, which we see clearly. But when we see it again, that not only are we commanded not to curse them, but these are the very three laws that were given to us at Mara. So now we have to understand why, at this juncture, God saw it vital. And this was right after the seashore where the Egyptians were destroyed. Now God brings them to Mara and teaches them about the Sabbath, recognizing God as the ultimate authority, dinim, meaning courts, recognizing the princes, and then kibud av aim, honoring parents, recognizing your parents. Why were these three specifically needed at this time? Okay. Now, there's one more thing to keep in mind here. I want you to just take, if you have the Chumash in front of you, take a look at Exodus 12:34. It may seem like a disjointed, but you'll see why I'm bringing it up. Take a look at Exodus 12:34. If you have that, I'll read it to you. It says, when the people were being rushed out, by the Egyptians because they said we're all going to be killed because this is now the plague of the firstborn. It says, again, 1234 in Exodus, the people lifted up Esbetseko, which means his. Literally, it's talking about it's an individual. Betseko is the loaf, the dough that they just had. They had it because they just had the command to have the Passover, the Paschal lamb. But as they're being rushed out, they all lifted up their loaf, individual, before it rose, before it became leaven, from their kneading troughs. All right? So it's very interesting how it talks about it in the individual. It should really say that they lifted up their loaves, plural. And it does it again in 39. When they left and they finally got to, I think it's Ramses. No, to Sukkos. Excuse me. They left Ramses. They got to a place called Sukkos. And it says in 1239, that the people baked the butzik. Again, individual. The loaf. It really should say the people baked the loaves. All right, so what is this idea that they're taking the loaves anyway? And why did God rush them out so the dough shouldn't rise? What is this concept that the dough should not rise? That God didn't want the dough to rise. So I think we may have mentioned this last week, but I'll just say it again because it's essential here, is that I had suggested, I didn't find support for it, but I was suggesting that why were they all in unison taking this loaf with them for the road? They could have had other food in the house, but they didn't. And it's interesting that the Torah uses it in an individual. It doesn't say they took their loaves, but they took the loaf, as if it's trying to point to some unified idea that they all shared, a unified view of this loaf. Now, if you recall, the Egyptians were the ones that had created bread. They're the ones that invented bread. So certainly they ate it. If you invent it, you eat it. But we know for a fact that the Jews ate the matzah in Egypt, the poor man's bread. So they downgraded the Jews by giving them just enough for sustenance. Just, you know, the previous type of bread that the Egyptians even had before they developed the real, you know, soft, chewable bread. But they didn't give that to the Jews. And you could see that once the Jews were free, it could very well be that they wanted to identify with that freedom. And how did they identify with freedom? They wanted the rich man's bread. They were now involved in making loaves of bread because they wanted a taste, a literal taste of freedom. This is why I believe they all had a loaf ready in their house at this point, because now they were finally free, they knew they were leaving, and they were all making this loaf as a real expression. Oh, I'm going to, like, it's like a person who finally has money, he wants to go out and have pate or whatever the delicacy, or aged steaks or venison, all the most fancy and exquisite meals a person wants to now indulge in. That's a real expression that I'm wealthy. So this is what the Jews were doing. However, God said, no, this is not why you're being freed. I'm not freeing you just so you could now be free per se. I'm not removing labor from you. I'm not going to destroy your oppressors just for the sake of letting you have a free life. God didn't do that with Adam. He created man, but he gave him commands. You have to know that your freedom is now to be serving me. Meaning, again, don't have this idea in your mind that it's now like a pressure cooker, that now I've got to be subservient to God, and that's it, or I'm going to get hit. It's true, there are punishments. But the reason why God wants you to feel the subservience is because he knows what can give you the greatest enjoyment in life. So he wants to push you in that direction. So he doesn't just create Adam and say, run and do what you want and live life the way you want, the way your emotions see fit. I'm giving you one command, like we said earlier, to teach you that the objective of man is to be with commands, meaning to recognize God as being authority. And now, when the Jews were about to leave, God didn't want them to have that sense of just complete abandonment of any type of authority anymore. That was dangerous. It was dangerous about the time they were going to leave Egypt. Now, and the Egyptians were now just killed on the seashore. So God does want to get rid of the oppressor, but not for the sake of just making the Jews unbridled and living completely unrestrained and 100% free. So therefore, when he now gets rid, when they're leaving Egypt, God does not allow the loaf to rise. He doesn't allow them to enjoy that taste of the complete freedom that they saw the Egyptians have, because you're not going to have that type of a life. You are now being freed for a purpose of having system of laws. Because look what the Egyptians did with freedom. They committed idolatry. They just let their emotions run, and this is where a person will go without direction. No man can exist without direction. That's why, as soon as God created the first man, he had to have a command. That was the first thing which happened as soon as God created man. Man cannot exist. No man can exist without commands. That would just destroy him. And we see that from Egypt. They became idolatrous. And the Jews leaving now, they wanted to have the taste of freedom, but God, he retarded the loaves in order to not let them have that outlet. And as soon as the Egyptians were killed on the seashore, where does God take them? He takes them to Marah, and he gives them these three laws, these commands. Now we see how it all fits. He takes them to a place, and he shows them, I'll be with you, I'll even make miracles for you. I'll take the bitter waters and make them sweet. However, now that your oppressors are gone, you might have another urge, another impetus to express that freedom again. Now we're going to give you these laws about honoring parents, the judges, the court system, and God himself. So now we understand why at this specific juncture it was vital to Jewish development, that for the nation, that they should now recognize that they are to be subservient to God, and that they shouldn't try to outlet that freedom. And Rabbi Chait said it beautifully once. He said that the very redemption of the Jews was synonymous with God being the Redeemer. As soon as they had the removal, it was for the sake of now coming under God's wings. So that's what it means, Goal Yisrael. Those are the words we say right before we say our Shemona Esrei every day, our the 18 prayers that we say three times a day, the essence of prayer. So right before we say that, we talk about God as being the Goel Yisrael, the Redeemer of Israel, meaning that now we were taken away from the wrong lifestyle, we were subservient to man, and we were brought to the right, we were redeemed, the Rabbi Chait means, that you're now realizing the real objective of the human being. It's not just that you're emancipating him from physical labor and an oppressor. That's just where you break a person out of prison and you let him run. That's not what God did. He took the person out of prison. He took the Jews out of prison and put them into the temple. He put them now into, he redeemed them. He realized the real objective is to recognize God. So that's why immediately upon the release, they could not be allowed to enjoy free man's bread, which would be just purely identification with freedom per se. And they had to receive laws immediately that had to do with acceptance of authority. And, of course, acceptance of parents and acceptance of the judges all target the primary authority figure, and that's God. Okay, let's pause here and see if there's any comments or questions.
It's really good. I like the connection of the bread.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
And
it's
allowed to rise.
Right. And that's like a central part, because it's not just, when we celebrate Passover, it's not just to recall the poor man's bread, but we're also recalling the speed that God caused the Exodus. But now we have to understand, why did God have to make it so speedy? What was so important not to allow the dough to rise? Well, what is so important about that? But I think this answers it.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So at this point, had the seven Noahide laws been forgotten? Was there no recollection?
I don't think so.
Because
why do you ask that?
Well, because, okay, they were, for example, the establishing courts of justice is already one of the seven laws, right? So why would they have to be told again?
The Gemara, actually the Talmud takes that up and ask your very question. And they say that it's they say, weren't the seven notified laws, don't they include courts? So they go through a couple of possibilities, but I think that concludes that now the Jews were being taught that they have to establish them in every city. That was not part of the seven Noahide laws earlier. Up to this point, they just had to have a court. It didn't have to be in every city, but they had to have the system somewhere. Now they're being taught it had to permeate throughout all cities and towns. Very good question.
Okay.
Is that Mary?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, very good. Right. But it fits smoothly. We see that we start uncovering more of a whole plan. Just from subtle, you know, the use of the word of a singular word of a loaf and not the plural. And you see that happens twice, so it's not accidental. God is actually trying to suggest something here with the words. There's many angles that we can derive ideas from just looking at the words. Like Rabbi Chaim remember saying years ago, he said, let the words talk to you. Meaning, when you're learning, the Torah is God's articulations. So, there's tremendous wisdom if you just let them talk. A lot of times when you hear people giving over ideas and this and that, that's so, it's not rooted in the words. So then you lose, you have a sense that you're not really sure that this is really hitting an idea that God intends. That's why it's so important that we're so true to the words and we look at the words themselves. And that, God wrote it in a way where we can derive the truth. And when we see those truths, then they're like, hammered nails, like King Solomon says at the end of Proverbs, I think. So the words of the rabbis are like, driven nails, when you hear how the lessons of the rabbis and the Talmud, and they take a lesson and they show you exactly how it fits perfectly. So then that really gives you a sense of, now I've seen another piece of reality. Now I've seen another real idea that God wants to communicate to us. And it's so clever how God encapsulated it in the Torah and wrote it a certain way, and he put two ideas in one verse. So it's a very, and that just drives you further to want to see even more in the future. So in all methods, it's in all manners, it's so beneficial. Right. Okay, any other comments? Any other questions?
We're good here.
Yeah. All right, I think that is pretty much what I wanted to address today. And, all right, so I guess we'll pick up next week. Maybe we'll continue this wrap. There's one more thing I do want to investigate, which I didn't get a chance this week, and that is about the, we touched on it last week, and that is the 12 pools of water and the 70 date palms, and the correlation between the 12 tribes, and some want to say the 70 elders, or it could be the 70 Jews that were the first Jews that descended to Egypt. But what is the lesson over there? And that wasn't really a miracle as much as when God told Moses to take the wood and put it in the water and it automatically sweetened the water. That's an outright miracle. So I wanted to just investigate that a little more in terms of what the nature of that lesson was, because that's what happens right after this whole point. So maybe we'll wrap up this section with that issue next week. All right?
Sounds good.
Okay. All right, so listen, I wish you all a good week. Any questions, feel free to call or, pop an email during the week. And we'll continue, and we'll make sure that this is placed online. If anybody who joined us today came in late, the whole class in its entirety will be placed on the audio section. It's on the left-hand side of the site, about eight links down is the audio link. So that'll be up there within a half an hour, just so you can hear the whole thing if you missed any part of it. All right, Doug, Cal, Brian, Mary, hope you have a good day. Enjoy the week.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay, be well.
Take care.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Take care. Okay, so that wraps up today's session, and I wish everybody a good day. Again, this class will be placed online shortly, so if you missed any part of it, you'll be able to hear the entire class in its entirety. And any questions during the week, feel free to email. And we'll try to get back to you with any other classes. And we'll continue next week, same time, on this same topic. All right, a good week to everybody.